Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have as my guest today Dan Simmons, and we'll be discussing The Terror, recently published by Little Brown. And first of all, Dan, thank you for taking time out of a busy schedule to make time to talk with us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
And first of all, I'd like to congratulate you on the success of The Terror. It's doing very well on the bestseller list. And I'd also like to mention that Children of the Night and Summer of Night have been reissued in mass market paperback by Little Brown. And so you have three new books actually out, all of which are doing well.
I'm glad to hear that. I like being a triple threat.
Yes, exactly. And Dan, I followed your career with quite a bit of interest over the years. And if you would, for the listeners, tell us a little bit about the beginning of your career, because you started out as an elementary educator and really came to writing really with the birth when your daughter was born. But you had quite a career in education before you wrote your first novel, which was The Song of Cali, which won the World Fantasy Award in 1985.
Yeah, I graduated from a good liberal arts college in 1970 as an English major with about 10 minors that could have been my major, including philosophy and art. Didn't know what to do, so happened to go get into a graduate program, became an elementary teacher, which I absolutely loved. I enjoyed teaching tremendously. And I taught for 18 years. The last 3 years was setting up a huge gifted talented program. Never call any kids gifted, but we provided third through sixth graders in a huge district that would amount to university-level instruction if they needed it. So I just loved it all. But in the late 70s, I went back to my love in college of trying to write with the idea of writing for publication, and decided to break in by trying to send short stories to science fiction magazines. And I had three stories accepted and three magazines die before they could publish them or pay me. Including Galaxy and Galileo, two magazines I like, so I decided I was killing off all my favorite magazines. And I knew how hard it was to be a published writer, so when we found out we were going to have a child, our first child turned out to be our only child, our daughter Jane, in 1981, I just gave it up. I went off to a writing conference just as a swan song. I wanted to see and hear a couple of writers I'd read for years, George R. R. Martin, Joanne Greenberg, and especially a guy named Harlan Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
To go to the workshop, you had to put some story in, so I tossed one in the pile just as my ticket to listen to people. And when Ellison critiqued that story, and that was quite a day, it sort of became a legend because he was eviscerating people left, right, and center. When he critiqued that story, he said, "Simmons, not many people hear the music, but those few who do have an obligation, a duty to try to become a writer, and you, my friend, are a writer." So it gave me an option, and I went for it.
Beautiful. Yeah, Harlan Ellison, he's a national treasure.
Well, I don't think enough people know that, but I was just filmed for a documentary about his life that I think is going to be on the Discovery Channel late spring or early summer, and it will remind a lot of people that he's still with us and still as irascible and as powerful as ever.
Yeah, that's good. That's important to hear. And Dan, you came out of the blocks fast. I mean, 1985, Song of Cali, 1989, Carrie and Comfort, then Hyperion, won the Hugo Award. And so you obviously, like Harlan Ellison said, you had a gift for it. But it looks to me like you also are a very hard and dedicated worker to your craft, because the books that you write are meticulously researched and very creative, and you have a commitment to your writing that is rarely found these days, I think.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I think probably a sense of discipline is what separates the 180 million or so people who want to write a book from the 500 to 700 in the nation who actually write fiction for a living. I mean, that's an appallingly low statistic percentage of people who can make a living writing, and only about 20% of Americans read a book a year, but about 80% say they're going to write a book.
Right.
It does take a certain amount of daily effort and concentration and sacrifice, actually. That's what Harlan talked about the day he gave me that curse of saying I should be a writer. He pointed out that others he had told probably would not be writers, he felt that he treated them harshly, but Harlan said, that it's you, Simmons, I'm giving the curse to, because, you know, years will go by with monetary worries. Weekend will go by where you can't spend time with your family because you're working. You'll miss movies. You'll miss evenings with your family. Everything he said was true. And it sort of separates writers from others. But I enjoy the research. I love the intensity of learning every time I enter into a new project. And even my science fiction novels have taken a tremendous amount of research.
Mm-hmm. And, Dan, let's talk about The Terror. It's it involves Sir John Franklin's last expedition. And it's a fascinating story. In May of 1845, 129 officers and men took two ships in search of the Northwest Passage in the Pacific, and they were never heard from again. And one of the things that struck me as I was reading the book was, you know, 1845 was not that long ago.
No, in one sense it wasn't, because especially in the Arctic, where the conditions they faced are exactly the same as conditions we face today, except the winters were much more terrible. It happened when they attempted those 1846 through 1849. Were some of the worst Arctic winters ever recorded. Now with global warming, it's a little different, but not much. It's still an alien planet. But in another sense, the Victorian age and psychology of those men is also an alien planet. They came out of a culture that just simply couldn't adapt the way the Eskimo had up there for tens of thousands of years to the environment. And they brought their culture and their attitudes with them, and in the end, I believe it killed them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And was this expedition something that had fascinated you over the course of your lifetime, or was it something that when you started reading about it, you just thought that you could take it and turn it into a great story?
Actually, I'd never heard of it until a week before I decided to write the novel about it. Most of my life, I was a kid in the great international geophysical year of 1957-58 when we went back to the South Pole and we went back to Antarctica after a 40-year hiatus, and it really captured my imagination. So all the decades since, I'd read a lot of expedition lore. But it was Antarctica, the South Pole, that interested me, the huge attempt down there, the heroic age of exploration with people like Scott and Shackleton. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write something set in Antarctica. But I knew I thought about doing a novel that I wanted some element that possibly was supernatural, but certainly was a metaphor for all of the forces trying to kill a human being in such a terrible environment. I wanted something frightening to embody the totality of the terror of the darkness, the months of darkness, and the inhuman lunar cold, and the winds, and the blizzards, and the isolation. And I didn't think a killer penguin was going to do it. So I decided I'd have to put my tail in the north, where there is still the largest, most ferocious, and intelligent predator on planet Earth to this day. That's the polar bear. We make them cuddly and cartoony, and we go to the zoo and laugh at them. But they're the only creature left on the planet that considers us a major source of food. When they encounter us, they either ignore us or eat us.
Mm-hmm.
And they're one of the most intelligent predators, perhaps the most intelligent a ferocious predator on Earth. So I wanted that to be part of the tale, and I ran into a footnote about the Franklin expedition and thought, yes, that's it.
That's fascinating. Yeah, the last 100 pages of the novel are just breathtaking, because when it all starts to come together, it really is like your worst nightmare come true. And one of the things I like, it always kind of irritates me as a reader and as a writer when people say, boy, Dan Simmons did a lot of great research for this book, because there's a lot of creativity that goes into that research as well. If it was just a matter of doing research and printing it out on the page, it would be an encyclopedia. The art is in taking the research that you've done and then creating a story around it that's mesmerizing to the reader, and that to me is the art. And sometimes people place too much emphasis on the research that the author does.
I appreciate you saying that, because the research is very important, but I wasn't interested in writing another nonfiction book about the Franklin expedition. There have been a few of those written, not many. But the truth is that of the hundreds of clues as to what happened to those 126 men and Sir John Franklin, none of it makes much sense. They're scattered ships. They've never found the ship's log. They've never found any real diaries that said what might have happened, why they abandoned the ships, why they made the decisions they did, where they were going in their last days, or what happened to them in the end. Everything is surmise. So when I did the research, I had a few thousand bits of evidence that added up to nothing. And most of the nonfiction about the Franklin Expedition, there are sweeping claims made, but that doesn't add up to much. And so the fictional construct was the part that excited me. And I just decided that Robert Frost once said that writing blank verse is like playing tennis without a net. So I decided to play tennis with this fictional story using the net of having the fiction accommodate and explain all of the known facts that we have, however contradictory they were. But you're right, the difficult part was in writing the fictional part of the tale.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, I'd also like to clue the listeners in to your website, dansimmons.com. I was perusing the website preparing for the interview, and you have a lot of really interesting things for writers on your website. Richard Curtis has an essay on publishing in the 21st century, which was just fascinating. And then you have Dan's 10 absolutely infallible predictions for 2007, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Yeah, they're absolutely infallible because they're cynical.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
But there's also a section, Writing Well. And if you would, talk a little bit about what you hope to accomplish with your Writing Well installments, because I read them, and I think there's a lot of very good practical wisdom in these columns that you post for free on your website.
Well, thanks. There are about 5 long Writing Well installments there now. It's just something I do when I have spare time, and I don't have much spare time. But I'm never very happy with books about writing. As an elementary teacher and as somebody who was certified to teach high school and who somebody as a writer who visits colleges, universities, and graduate schools and adult writing workshops from time to time, I know it's very difficult but possible to help somebody make a quantum leap in the quality of their writing. But most books one reads are like recipes. They're like self-help books, and that's not the way it's going to work. So in my Writing Well series on my dansimmons.com website, I look at writing as a way people can see first how difficult it is, but how they can find the quality of their writing through the quality of their reading. We look at writers, their style, what makes a real professional writer different than the millions of others who would like to be writers, and the idea is that it creates some resonance in the serious amateur writer who's willing to put in the eve effort and apprenticeship to try to become a published writer themselves if they wish to. So we take a look at Writing Way by Scott Fitzgerald, and we look at styles of writing with Henry James and Flaubert and so forth, set out ways that we can analyze such writing, see how it reflects today on modern literature, critiquing manuscripts and so forth. They talk about the effect of books and these kind of writers on their own work. Mm-hmm. So I'm enjoying it.
Good. And your career, I just find it fascinating when I look at your bibliography. It appears to me that you find something you're interested in, and then off you go to pursue it. For example, the Joe Kurtz novels, Hard Case, Hard Freeze, and Hard as Nails, you published in 01, 02, 03. Which would be in the mystery genre, and I read them, enjoyed them very much. And was that just something you felt like at the time you wanted to kind of expand and write in that genre for a while, or?
Yes, if I have a major weakness, is that I give in to impulse and just do something for the fun of it too frequently, leaping from genre to genre. But in this case, I was researching a very large book and working on it, and there were just a lot of things in personal life colliding, and I enjoy hard-boiled mystery fiction, like Donald Westlake writing as Richard Stark, the Parker the Thief novels going back to the 50s that not enough people know about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote the first Joe Kurtz hard-boiled, ultra-hard-boiled novel. Part of it was written on a laptop just sitting in hospital waiting rooms and so forth. It was a bad year, and it was a wonderful catharsis. And the publisher wanted some more, so we agreed to a 4-book contract. And they're little books, but I put as much effort into them as I do a major historical thriller novel. But I did finally buy back the last book. It's not written.
I had a feeling that might be the case. And then occasionally you did Crook Factory, which was a fictional account of Hemingway's involvement with the government in Cuba, which was just something completely off the wall and different. And that's why I think that readers of The Terror are going to find, as they go through your backlist, that they're going to be delighted that they're not going to get the same book over and over again.
Yes, and that's a blessing for readers and also a curse, because one of the facts about modern publishing, modern readership, and being a writerly success in the 21st century is that people expect the same book over and over again. And although I've always tried to give full, honest weight on my novels, I really have a resistance to writing the same thing again. I could have spent the rest of my life writing science fiction novels in the so-called Hyperion universe of four of my most popular novels, but I'll never write another book there. But thank you, because I do like to try new things. But I am, I just got back from New York, where I've been talking to my new publisher, Little Brown, and we now have three books planned, one yet to be determined, but I have a three-book contract with them, and I'm going to stay in the historical thriller mode for a while. I'm going to stick to my knitting for a couple of years, which I haven't done for a while.
Well, that's good, and I know that Little Brown is, I know they're firmly behind your career and are very excited to have you in their roster of writers, and so congratulations on getting them as a publisher. I think they do a great job.
Thank you. I think it's a wonderful imprint, and I have to admit, I like pretty books, beautiful books, and they did a fine job in a hardcover version of The Terror, and I look forward to more of that from them for future books.
Yeah. Dan, I know you've been holed up in New York for a while, and what I'd like to ask is, what are you happiest about with The Terror? You've now that it's in the bookshelves, it's hit the bestseller list, and the acceptance that it's gaining in the public arena?
Well, first of all, The Terror was an idea of mine that at first very few people were interested in. I actually had a publisher tell me that no one would really be interested in reading about people who died 160 years ago, and that sort of befuddled me. I didn't understand that at all. But I had to buy a book back, two books back, actually, to buy my time and space to write this, and I wrote it on spec, just without any advance money and so forth, for the first time in about 20 years. So all the way through, it was a vision that I had that it wasn't shared by a large group. When Little Brown was interested in it, there was a long delayed publication, but it still needed a lot of shepherding to keep it in the shape I wanted. So what I'm most happy about is that it seemed to reach the wider readership that I've been looking for, waiting for a while. I love my audiences, and they've been loyal in science fiction, some in mystery, some in thrillers, some in horror, some in my mainstream odd novels like Phase of Gravity. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the first times that those audiences seem to have come together and joined with a new audience, and also received a new set of reviewers, where I'm not just reviewed by a science fiction reviewer. I'm not just reviewed, you know, in a trade magazine like Locus. This has been one of the widest sets of reviews by serious reviewers I've ever had, and all I've asked for was that, you know, honest chance to get that sort of readership and reviewing, and I've been very lucky in that it seems to work very well at The Terror, and now I want to continue that dialogue with those readers.
That's beautiful. Just out of curiosity, Dan, how long did it take you to write The Terror?
9 months.
9 months. Wow.
1 month of beginning research when I knew it was coming together and there was a book there, and then 8.5 months of serious 7-day-a-week, 12-hour-day writing where I had no idea how it would end. I just knew I didn't want a sort of a survival book where no one survived. I didn't want to write another, gee, they all went up there and died terribly of scurvy novel. So I just trusted. After 24 books, this was my 24th book, after 24 books, 19 of them being novels, you just have to trust your instincts that things will come together in the organic writing of a tale that will satisfy you.
What I'm excited about is, as I was reading some of your essays on writing well, one of the things that drives me crazy is I go to writers' conferences and I talk to a lot of writers and agents, and there's this concept that you have to grab the reader's attention in the first sentence or the first paragraph or the first page. And I find that so demeaning as a reader that a new writer feels that they have to that they have the attention of the reader for one page, and that's why I'm so delightful to see The Terror having the success it is, because it gives the reader, it gives the publishers the belief that the readers, if they like the story and it's well told, they're going to stick with the story and they're going to read the book. It doesn't all have to take place in the first two pages.
I appreciate you saying that, because this is one of my pet peeves. Just about a year ago, I went to a very large writer's workshop. I gave the major address to about 2,000 people. I taught for 2.5 days. I didn't ask about pay, and in the end, they gave me a total pay of $100. But I love working with young writers, but I was appalled at what I heard and saw being taught and pushed and promulgated at this writer's workshop by the administration there and by too many of the hack writers that nobody's brought in to teach the would-be writers who are paying thousands of dollars to go to this thing. They have to have an elevator pitch. They have to grab the reader. They have, first of all, grab the editor in one sentence or less. It has to be high concept, as if you're pitching something to Hollywood producers. You have to be able to give the whole idea of the book in an elevator ride between two floors. And this is garbage. This is junk. I'm so sick of people condescending to readers. Readers are the most intelligent people we have in the United States. These are people who can read Proust, where you have to get through 300 pages before it begins to warm up. So, yes, there are a group of readers who, you know, are going to grab a paperback for the airplane flight, and if the first paragraph isn't a killer, then they won't go further. But I'd say the other 97% of readers know good writing and will stay with a writer and a tale to see how rich it is. The whole thing's based on trust between the writer and the reader. And the people who at workshops that keep telling you how you have to hook everybody in the first two paragraphs, they don't know what they're doing. They're just hacks.
Yeah,
my friend, vehemence, but I really feel strongly about this.
No, I agree. And my friend Andre Debuse, the father, said that modern media, we vastly underestimate the intelligence of the American people, and that's one reason why people go to bars and restaurants, is because if they turn on the television or go to the movies, what they see is so poorly written that it's insulting to them.
Yeah, we keep saying that because of the avalanche of media and the things that distract us. Everything is made to distract us, so everything has to hook us in within a few seconds. And it has hurt attention span. As an educator for 18 years, I watched it from 1970 through 1987. I watched kids' attention spans get fractured and scattered. But attention is attention, and you can train it. And it's one of the things I did as a teacher with sixth grade students is lengthen their attention span and their interest in and their eagerness for something deeper and wider. And so it can be regained. I think as a culture we have to regain it. The one place that is left where you go into a long commitment of continued heightened attention, I believe, is in reading books. And so I'll be damned if I'll let people steal that from us.
Yeah, absolutely. You and me both. Well, Dan, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I really have enjoyed it. And I strongly recommend The Terror. It's something that if you're tired of going into the bookstore and pulling off a 250-page novel there where you know what's going to happen by page 15, pick up a copy of The Terror, sit back, relax, and enjoy it. And it's a hell of a story. The prose is stunning, and Dan, I look forward to getting caught up with you when the next book comes out.
Thank you for the great questions and the kind comments, and for letting me talk to your listeners. Thanks a lot.